Go, entity of 212, complex.
DPS.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
PUS.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Booster.
Go.
Copy that. We have a go from you guys.
This is Talking Sound.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Talking Sound podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. Talking Sound is now officially brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like me, have a podcast that you want to start up, have one that you want to take to the next level, stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. Use the code TalkingSound20 on checkout to save 20%. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. The code is TalkingSound20. Our guest today is brought to you by the amazing Cujo Limited. Kenny Aronoff is with us, a legendary drummer of amazing bands like John Mellencamp, John Fogerty, just to name a couple. I mean, the list goes on and on. Welcome to the show today, Kenny. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. I'm doing great. Just working on 31 songs for a Joe Satriani tour and three speeches I'm giving next week in Indiana for some corporations and an evening with Kenny Aronoff at a theater. It's like a sold out evening where I do a motivational presentation along with performing too.
Oh, wow. That is incredible. And that's something that I definitely want to talk about with you, because it's not often that you find a musician, an artist that is out there actively as a speaker and an author as well. There are so many facets to you and what you do whenever you go and actually check everything out on KennyAronoff.com. Tell us a little bit, just to start off with, familiarize our audience with your past, your passion. How was it that you came into music to begin with? And how was it that you became a drummer? How did you find your path to that, Kenny?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there was always music on the turntable when I was a kid. My parents grew up in New York, and so they were into jazz and into classical music. And my mom was in the show tunes because, you know, Broadway was right there. So there was always music on the turntable all the time. And so, and they would take me to Tanglewood, which was 3 miles from the home I grew up in, Western Mass. And Tanglewood is a summer home for the Boston Symphony Orchestra, where they'll do a whole season in 8 weeks at this venue. It's gorgeous. And and that very venue was when rock and roll came about. That was a venue that, you know, you could put probably, you know, 20,000 people in that venue, like 8,000 under the roof, but then the lawn was there. I mean, that's why I saw The Who. I saw, you know, Santana, Miles Davis, Gentle Tull, Jefferson Airplane, Sly and the Family Stone, and on and on. I mean, but anyway, so but when I was 10 years old, there was nothing to watch on TV as a child. And I was playing outside, and my mom yelled at me and my brother and sister to come in the house immediately, and we thought we were in trouble. But instead, when we got to the family room, my mom was pointing to a black and white RCA TV set that we had that had like rabbit ears to get better reception because we were up in the hills, you know, the mountains. There was this show called The Ed Sullivan Show, and Ed introduced these guys. I didn't even hear their name, and it was, you know, they were in suits, they had long hair, they looked different, they were a rock and roll band, they had electric guitars, drums. And the lead singer went up to the microphone and started singing, "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah." And they broke into this song, and I'm like bouncing off the walls, and I'm like, all I knew, I was electrified, and I wanted to be part of this. And I just said, "Mom, who are these guys?" And she said, "Well, they're the Beatles." And I said, "Well, I want to play in the Beatles. Call them up. Get me in the band. I want to do this. And I want to play drum set. And forget about the piano lessons. I want to play drum set." And, of course, she didn't call the Beatles up. She didn't even have a number. But that's what a 10-year-old kid, you know.
Yeah.
What else are you going to do? And so there was no mentor. There was nobody to tell me how to be. Rock and roll, it just started. So I borrowed $20 and got a snare drum and a cymbal. And I started my own band called the Alley Cats. And all I did, I stood up and played because I didn't have a bass drum. I couldn't afford it. And we played Beatles music. And, you know, when I shut my eyes, I thought I was in the Beatles. And that was the start. And I tell people that the moment that I saw the Beatles on TV, I realized what my purpose in life was. It hit me in the gut. You realize, you know, your purpose in life is not a mental thing. It can start as a mental thing, but to really realize why you're here. I mean, think about it. What are you friggin' doing on this planet? It's only like 90 years, 100 years of life.
Yeah.
And why tell people when I give these motivational presentations, I said, look, when you realize what your purpose is in life, what when you realize what motivates you, what your passion, what your deepest desires, what your truth is, who you are, when you live by that, you will be unstoppable. You'll be undeniable. You'll be 100% you. You'll be authentic because you can't not be you. And I'm the guy that wakes up every morning excited about what I'm going to do. And I'm also the guy that doesn't want to turn the lights off at night because I'm still digging what I'm doing. And I'm thinking about how cool it is going to be doing this tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that's coming from a place in my heart. It's not, you know what I mean? When you're doing it just from your brain, you're just clocking in. Guys like me will smoke you because I'm like the Tom Brady, you know, of music. I just love what I do. And you know, you don't want to be on your deathbed, you know, going like, what the fuck? You know, what am I doing? And then die. Anyway, so I took bands and it was time to go to college. And my parents, everybody went to college when I was a kid. Parents said, what do you want to major in? And I said, music. But there was no school of rock. There was no teaching. There was no manual. There was no, like, this is how you become a rock star. So I had been taking lessons from the percussionist, from the Boston Symphony Orchestra, learning how to read and play timpani, mallets, which is vibes, marimba, xylophone, snare drum, and just a good enough, okay enough to get into an okay college, University of Massachusetts.
Okay.
Which is more of an educational school.
Yep.
And I knew right away that I wasn't the best, that's for sure. But I knew right away I had a lot of catching up to do, but I knew I didn't want to stay there for 4 years. So the top three schools in the country are Indiana University School of Music in Bloomington, which is now called Jacobs School, Juilliard in New York, and Eastman up in Rochester. Well, Eastman was 5 hours from my school. So I auditioned to transfer. I get in. But there's no room for me. There's a girl as a junior at UMass who's talking about going to Aspen School of Music. I'm like, what's Aspen School of Music? She's run by Juilliard. It's an elite orchestra that you audition for to get in. I auditioned because I wanted to go where she was going. I auditioned, and I don't hear from them. And the last day of school, you know, I'm going to go home. I got an Allman Brothers band. I'm going to take lessons from the percussionist from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I go to get my mail, and there's a check in there. And I'm like, oh, no, what's this for? I open it up. It's not a check. I got accepted to Aspen, and I have to go in 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Which tells me I was an alternate. There's no way. So anyway, I go to Aspen. I am absolutely clearly the worst percussionist there. These kids have been playing timpani since they were in their diapers. They all were like Juilliard prep kids, and they were just amazing. And I'm just learning scales. I got ridiculed, humiliated by conductors when I lost my place, and it was horrible. But the teacher who taught there at Aspen ran the percussion department at Indiana University School of Music, number one school. And I said, I want to go to Indiana. And he says, well, you know, why don't you come back in January and audition? No, now. I want to go now. I want to go from Aspen to Indiana and get my degree there. And he looked at me and he went, well, all right. He was probably thinking, this guy wants it, and then he's going to work for me. So in order to get Indiana University, you have to audition for four departments. Well, there were people who taught at Indiana University at Aspen in woodwinds, brass, I think opera and percussion. And I auditioned, I get in. Spent 4 years at Indiana University working my way from the bottom to the top. And let me be clear, getting in is hard, staying in is harder. You're tested every semester. And if you don't stay up to standards, you get washed out. But that training is unbelievable. I had to do an opera every semester. But the bottom line, and I'm getting to the end of this, is every summer I would audition to the number one student orchestra in the country, which is at Tanglewood, run by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, 3 miles from my house. The first year I auditioned for Vic Firth, timpanist of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, biggest, you know, stick company in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I audition, I strike out. I go back the next year in the spring. You know, you audition in the spring. I strike out. I go back a third year. I strike out. I go back a fourth year and I get in. There's only 7 percussionists in the world that get in. It was at that program I got to work with the iconic, legendary American composer conductors Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, not to mention the conductors Seiji Ozawa, Arthur Fiedler, and on and on. I graduate Indiana University, and I get into the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. Huge honor to be in an orchestra, because there aren't that many in the world. My parents are ecstatic. My friends are ecstatic. I'm blown away. But I turned it down, and here's why. I turned down certainty for possibility or uncertainty. I turned it down because my brain was telling me you should do this. My heart was telling me I want to be a drummer, a set drummer. So I humbly moved back to my parents' house, practiced 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, studied with a real legit drum set teacher in Boston and one in New York. See, at Indiana University, they didn't even have drum set instructor there. It was all timpani and mallets and theory and conducting, stuff like that. I moved back to Indiana. The former band, the business model was we write songs, we get in a house, we had a band house, we write songs, we get a record deal, we make records and tour. Well, after 3 years of this attempt, we failed. I'm 27 years old, 5 years of college, 4 years of trying to get in a rock band, and I'm like, what the hell am I doing now? I decided to move to New York because I knew more people there. And 2 weeks before I go, I'm walking out of a restaurant, and I bump into a singer-songwriter, Ruthie Allen, and I tell her, she asks what I'm doing. I said, I'm doing this. Hey, you know, there's this guy. You know, this guy, he's on this new TV show called MTV, and he makes records, and he's getting up there. He's doing all right. Just came back opening for Kiss, and he fired his drummer last night. And I went, I knew who it was, and I kind of, music was all right. It was very, very commercial. I went, and all of a sudden, bing, a light went off. I went, are you kidding me? This is what I want. This is the Beatles. It's what I always wanted to do. So I get on, to make it a long story short, I get on the phone, I get the audition, I memorize every drum beat that was on the record that they had just put out that year. I come in, I crush the audition, and I won't even tell you who it is yet. And I get in, and 5 weeks later, we're in L.A. making a record. I'm ecstatic. I tell everybody, dude, I've made it. I'm going to be on MTV. I'm going to be on the radio. I'm touring. I'm in a rock band. This is unbelievable. I'm excited. And after 2 days of recording, I'm fired.
Oh, no.
From the record. And the reason why was the producer said, I need to get this record done in 8 weeks. And the hardest thing to record is drums. You have to have drums first. So that if there's any, you can always fix guitars, but it's hard to fix drums back then when it was tape. So we have a good drum. So that Kenny has not had any experience making records that get on the radio to be number one hits. And there's an art form to it. It's just like anything else. It didn't matter that I won concerto competitions and played with Leonard Bernstein. That didn't have anything to do with recording for hit radio, you know? So my boss is telling me, you go home and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I ain't going anywhere. This was a definitive moment in my life because I said, I'm not going anywhere. And they're all looking at me. The band is looking at me like, whoa, what? He just told you to go home and you're saying no? Because he was kind of the boss was kind of a drill sergeant. And I said, no. I said, listen, I'm fighting for my life now. Life-changing moment. I said, well, am I still the drummer in your band or what? And he looks at me and goes, well, yeah, but you're not playing drums on this record. I said, well, I'm fumbling. I'm going, well, I'm going to stay and I'm going to watch the session guys play. I'm going to learn from them and I'll get better and I'll benefit from that. And you'll benefit because I'm your drummer, right?
Yeah.
Silence. And I'm like, oh, shit. And I say, well, you don't have to pay me. Bingo. Like that.
Yeah, yeah.
What employer doesn't love that? So, yeah, I stayed for 4 weeks. And, you know, it was like you're looking through a telescope. You know, the universe is a lot going up there. When I was studying classical music and playing jazz and being technical, well, playing with this artist was like looking through a microscope, the opposite direction. But both worlds exist, and both are very complex. So I went home and revamped my whole approach to drumming, created a new business model. How do I serve this artist? How do I serve his music? How do I play that makes it work for me to be part of this band? Mm-hmm. And I made a vow I'd be on the next record. I don't care what hell I went through. Well, let's jump ahead 2 years. I'm on the next record. All right. Two guys got fired during the record. I almost got a fist fight with the boss. It's not a fun record. I walk in one day, and the co-producer has this metal box. I went, Don, what's that? He says, oh, it's a one drum machine. I went, drum machine? Yeah, he says, the Bee Gees are using it next door. It's a cool new sound. This is 1981.
Yeah.
It's a new sound, man. It's like hip. I went, well, what are you doing with it? He says, well, can you use it on this song? I'm like, I'm being replaced.
You're being fired again?
A drum machine? I got replaced by two humans 2 years ago. Now a machine? I grab it. I said, well, I'm going to program it because I wanted to be part of it. Program it, give it back to them. I'd get the manual out, and I just basically took the beat I was playing on the drums and kind of programmed it in this machine, but the sounds were different. I give it back to them. I'm sitting in the lounge going, what's going on with my... Drummers are being replaced by machines. This is not right. And I get summoned 2 hours later in the control room. The boss goes, hey, we need a drum fill or a drum break or a solo right after the second chorus. And I'm like excited because I'm going to be on the record, and I'm crapping in my pants because I'm thinking, holy shit, you got to save the song to save your career. That's it.
Oh, man.
And so we spent the day getting the drum sounds, and I'm thinking, okay, I got to come up with something that's going to jump out of little speakers on stereos and cars and on home stereos and radios and, you know, TV speakers. And I'm thinking, I got to come up with something that's really cool and definitive. So when it was finally that time to play, my entrance was boom, blam. That's all I did. It was like the machine's going, dish, 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 ka. Boom, blam, and I stop. Just simple, powerful, in your face. I look up and look at the control room. There's 9 guys in there with their fingers up, like, good job. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm scared. And I'm thinking, I still got my job, man. They like what I did so far.
Right.
So I tried some stuff, and I hit a dead end. I'm summoned into the control room, and now you got everybody telling you what not to play, what to play, critical moment. I'm thinking, dude, you got to save your career right now. I'm heading back 50 feet to the drum set. I'm like, dude, save your career, man. What are you going to play? I don't know. 30 feet. What are you going to play? 20 feet. I don't know. 10 feet. Kenny, this is it. I turn around and look at the drums and look at them. I look at the drums and look at them. And also, bing. Instead of changing everything I was doing, I just kind of looked at it differently. Shifted it. It'd be like if you looked at a room with furniture and you go, this sucks. You go, well, you got 2 choices. Mm-hmm. Get rid of all the furniture, buy new furniture, or rearrange it. Just move shit around. That's what I did. Long and short of it, I come up with this cool part. That song is Jack and Diane, John Cougar Mellencamp's biggest, most successful money-making hit he's ever had. I saved my ass, blew his career up, won 2 Grammys, and sold millions of records, and now I was a member of the band, meaning I served him well, served the song well. There was no way he was getting rid of me now, and I spent 17 years coming up with drum beats for songs he would play on acoustic guitar, and I came up with a method that I would use and I share with people to help me when you're in a tense, uptight, critical situation like that. And basically what I do when John would play a song, he played a song twice ago, what do you got? Well, obviously he's asking me because I did it once with Jack and Diane. I went, so what I did is I came up with this method. And here's the method. It's 4 steps. It's so simple. First thing you do is you think, what is the obvious thing? And by the way, this applies to music or sports or if you're in a business meeting and people are talking, you know they're going to want to ask your opinion. You always think, what is the obvious answer? And then you go, number 2, well, what's a little bit different? A little bit embellish it. What's a little bit outside the box? 3, a little bit more. Finally, 4, you go way outside of the box. Completely like something crazy. And that worked over and over again. All right, I'm going to continue a little bit here now. So I have established myself in a band that is all over MTV. We were selling out arenas all over the United States. That's, you know, 20,000 a night in a private jet, say, at Ritz-Carlton, Four Seasons. I'm a rock star. We live in a life. And all of a sudden, 8 years later, John quits. John Mellencamp said, I've had enough. I quit, taking 3 years off. Now, I just gotten divorced. I was thinking, when he said that, I believed him. I was freaking. And I was freaking. And the next day I woke up, I went, you know what? Once again, life-changing moment. I said to myself, you know, I've been working with one artist for 8 years, and I've given everything to him, and he can just quit? And I'm like, whoa, how am I going to make my living? I went, now I'm going to go work with all the other artists. I went out to L.A., spent a year pounding the street, and eventually got a big break, and I became a huge session drummer. Next thing you know, I'm doing Iggy Pop, Elton John, Bob Seger, Bob Dylan, Bon Jovi, and on and on and on. Then I got drum sets in Nashville. I went after Nashville because I could drive to Nashville from Indiana in 4.5 hours. I fly to L.A. 4.5 hours. I had two sets in Nashville, two sets in Indiana, L.A., two sets in New York, and a lot of sets in Indiana. And people would fly me all over the world. And eventually, to this day, I've recorded over 300 million records sold. And that now meant I had two careers. Usually when you're a drummer, you're either a session guy or a touring guy.
Yep.
I'm successful at both. Because, I mean, I did 17 years with Mellencamp, one tour with the great Bob Seger, 10 years with Joe Cocker, 10 years with Melissa Etheridge.
Wow.
I've subbed on Goo Goo Dolls, Styx, Chickenfoot, which is two guys from Van Halen, you know, Sammy Hagar, Michael Anthony, Joe Satriani, and me, Chad Smith from the Chili Peppers was the original member, but when he went back to the Chili Peppers, I subbed for him. Now I'm going out for a year and a half with Joe Satriani, and I've done 27 years with John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater. I did the Smashing Pumpkins for a year. Wow. So I became this big touring guy, and I became this big session guy. But what's even crazier and more rewarding is I broke all the barriers with style. Because, so, you know, I did like the Mellencamp and the Elton Johns and the Rod Stewart and the Santana song. And you know, Melissa has a very rootsy, you know, singer-songwriter, Celine Dion, did Bon Jovi. But I also did Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Chris Christopherson, and Waylon Jennings.
Yeah.
I did the last Highwayman record. I performed live with George Jones, and I played, you know, Loretta Lynn. I've done the R&B people. I've done Buddy Guy, B.B. King. I've done, Bonnie Raitt. I performed with Ray Charles twice. I've done the girls, Celine Dion, Melissa Etheridge, Avril Lavigne, Michelle Branch, you know, Alanis Morissette. And I crossed all the different barriers, which is not an easy thing to do because people typically go, oh, he's a rock drummer, get somebody else. Somehow I made it work. So that's kind of the big and long short of the story. Now, I guess where I am now, and this is a key thing that I speak about, and that is you have to stay relevant in any business you're in by adapting and adjusting over and over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
The music business went from, you know, LPs to cassettes to CDs, and then the CDs turned into frisbees, and then everything turned into freebies.
Yeah.
So music became free. My business suddenly lost good billions of dollars, where the artists would make tons of money on record sales, publishing, producers, all gone. So I remember, you know, I was in L.A., and I, you know, they'd fly me first class. I did a rental car, per diem, fancy hotels, anything. Cartage company set up all my drums. Sometimes I'd have three sets of drums set up in three different studios in L.A. or Nashville. All that went away. So this good lady, this project coordinator, says, hey, Kenny, she calls me up and says, hey, are you in town, blah, blah, blah. We got this session. I went, well, aren't they going to fly me in? She said, well, and I said, are the budgets changing? And she said, yeah. So I went, that's not going to work. 1 month later, I had an apartment in L.A. Because I said to myself, all right, you can take away my money, but don't take away my career, man. I am not going to be left in the dust. So I got the apartment now. I have $3,000 a month more expenses, you know, apartment, utilities, rental car, and flights. And I went, you know, and then the next level was I got another apartment, so I have more space. And eventually I had to sell my house in Indiana, 6,500 square foot house, put stuff in storage. Eventually got a semi, picked everything up out of Indiana, went down to Nashville, picked everything up that was there, 62 drums, moved everything out to L.A., and then now I have a studio where it's way more cost-effective for people to send me files. And, you know, I do sessions in my studio. I have an engineer. You can go on Uncommon Studios L.A. Yep. and, you know, see that. Or if people want to hire me, they go to my website and just send me an email. You know, KennyAContact@gmail.com, KennyAContact@gmail.com, and I tell them what my fees are. It's that simple. I give three takes for every song. Somebody PayPals me the money, and the rest send the songs. I could do as many as 11 songs in a day, and I love it. The main thing is I kept that part of my... which is a very big part of what I do, is recording. You know, I became really good at it. Mm. So I don't want to give that up. So I do that in a tour. And the speaking thing came about because, I mean, I'll back up. I did drum clinics, which was an evening with Kenny Aronoff talking about, you know, I play music and I have a kind of a format. But it was more about drumming and music. And I did that for 30 years. But when my autobiography came out, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, I was doing a lecture on my autobiography, and I put together a show, you know, an hour, hour and a half, actually it was 2 hours at one point, with slides and movies, and then I started to get, you know, work with a coach, and I developed a more professional show, and now I do corporate events where, you know, I do, my basic theme is on, you know, teamwork, leadership skills, communication skills, you know, because think about it. I mean, when you're walking into a session, do Elton John.
Yeah.
I've never met the guy. I have to be able to walk in and connect with him. I have to be able to start
rapidly
communicating with him, because in about 45 minutes, I'm going to be collaborating with him.
Yep.
And I'll do like, this is a typical, this was a scenario. Monday, Bonnie Raitt and B.B. King doing a soundtrack for Air America. Tuesday, Wednesday, four songs with Elton John. Thursday through Sunday, Bob Seger record. Monday, fly to Athens, Georgia, do a week with the Indigo Girls. Fly back to L.A., Willie Nelson for one day. Four more days with Seger. 2 weeks with Bon Jovi doing Blaze of Glory. And it just kept going and going and going and going.
Yeah.
You have to come in to these places and get along with people. I started realizing, that I was getting hired as much for my talent as my ability to motivate the room, to get along.
Mm-hmm.
The producer's going to hire a drummer who's talented, but he's a jackass. He's going to ruin the session. You need to get a guy who's a great drummer, but also gets along, is a team player, serves the artist, serves the band, serves the engineer, serves the musician, serves the personal hire, serves the record label, serves the assistant, serve everybody. You're humble and hungry. And so... that's pretty much my story. I figured I'd just tell it all in one skate.
Well, and what I love, Kenny, is the fact that despite all the names and everything else, you're still humble and you're still hustling, as you put it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't not work because it's what you love to do. It's your passion. And and that just absolutely bleeds through. I mean, it's one of those, I'm in my home studio surrounded by gear, and I'm on the road normally hooking up other people's gear. People don't get the fact that if I wasn't on the road doing it for you, I'd be doing it for me at home. And to find that, to be able to go out and speak to people about finding that passion and following that, what has it done for you to transition into that world of speaking and kind of getting people to understand that shorthand synergy that happens between musicians, you know, kind of that gut feeling that you get on stage,
mm-hmm.
where you do learn to read each other really rapidly. And what has that been like for you to try to explain that to people that are not in that moment, per se?
Well, first of all, either you get it or you don't. So, like, in other words,
yeah.
If I'm saying something and it resonates with somebody, that means they already have it in them anyway. So, like, you know, if I were to ask you to name three of your heroes and what are their attributes, you go, okay, that person, I like them because of this. Well, then I would tell you, you already have that in you. Otherwise, you wouldn't have even recognized those attributes in a person. So my thing is that I've done the work, and I'm just continuing to do the work. And the speaking business is an incredible arena or venue for me to do a lot of self-development at the next level that's beyond playing music, to do some work. And then here's a place where I can then put that work into motion and share it with people. And it does, you know, okay. Part of playing music was a large part of playing music was it made me feel good. But
yeah.
The other component was I realized it made me feel great and even better when I saw how good it made other people feel.
Yeah.
So my excitement, I didn't even know about it. I was naive. I was a kid doing whatever felt good. When I saw how people reacted to me, you know, later on when I started to step out of my own head, I'm like, my God, I got this energy. And then it makes other people play with more energy. They want to be around me. Then the band then goes and plays in front of an audience, and I can motivate the band that then motivates the audience. And it's just, man, what a great reward. So the combination of me feeling good and making other people feel good makes me feel phenomenal. And I enjoy music from an emotional, a spiritual, a mental, and physical place. The speaking is the same thing, because I play. I come out and I play immediately. Bam! Hit you right in the face, and then I step forward. And then I start speaking. And if I can motivate somebody and excite them, and that's why I love always hearing this. Damn, I was so inspired.
Yeah.
Because the playing part, I get it. They're going to go like, oh, man, because they don't see a musician up close like that every day. I've just put in the work, 60 years or however it is, a billion years. I'd be a retard if I didn't get better. So I've gotten really good. I'm an expert at playing the drums, I'm going to expect them to say, hey, I like your drumming. But when they say they're inspired, oh, my God. Wow, that's such a compliment.
Yeah.
And so I'm really motivated to continue to be what I am, which is a drummer, session drummer, performing drummer, and now couple that with being a speaker. I've written another book, but I haven't put it out, so I'm updating it. And continue to do what I'm doing, but add this to my palette of what I do. So it's really, really, it's exhilarating and exciting. So in a big picture, if you get a person that is is very experienced and learned all these things beyond consciousness, more even intuitiveness, like you mentioned, it's from a spiritual place, and you put those two worlds together, and then I can go out in front of people and trigger or wake up what's already in them or motivate them to continue doing what they're doing. Well, I mean, it's kind of keeping the whole world going and not going in a, you know, it's a positive thing, which keeps everything moving forward. I mean, what else do we do? We're ants on a planet, and you got two choices, live or die, and I'm a guy who wants to live. So there's a lot, most people want to live. So if you're helping people be the best that they can be, man, that's cool. That's great.
Yeah.
And I learn a lot by doing it. I learn so much doing it. I'm humbled and hungry every day.
And that's a beautiful way to put that, humbled and hungry, because, you know, you can't stop feeding that passion. Once it's there, once that fire is lit, it is, it's literally an all-consuming fire. Once you really do find the vocation that you're supposed to be doing in life. And to hear someone like you that is so entrenched in a dogged industry like rock and roll, that is hard schedules, like you're saying, a lot of travel, like consistently, but the fact that you still look at it as the fact of, I don't work a day because I love what I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's work. It doesn't work, but I love what I do, which allows me to take on so much because I love it. It's hard to say no.
Yeah.
Example, earlier this year, I was playing, you know, with Fogerty, you know, for 2 weeks at the Wynn in Vegas, and I got on a plane, flew to Russia, got off the plane, landed, went right to the Kremlin to start rehearsing. Because the next day, I had to perform, record video, and perform a final performance of this famous band. It was their 50th year. I had to perform 31 songs with a barely rehearsal the next day. And I told them, please send me the latest versions of all the songs that you've changed. They changed 25 out of the 31 and never sent me a revision. And so I'm learning and writing all this stuff down, you know, from 11 in the morning until 6 at night, and 1 hour break, and 7 to 11, a 4 hour concert. And some of the songs I didn't even get a chance to rehearse. There was not a drummer there, but it was that was not the way I like to do things. But because I loved what I do, I was able to handle that situation, that stress, and the craziness. And as somebody said, there was two American people, me and this other guy, that were, you know, the celebrities to play with this Russian band. And the guy said, you know, King, I know 6 badass drummers that could do this job, but they could not do the job. They would never have put up with what you put up. They would have walked out. And you stayed here and you never bitched, you never moaned. You just did your job, man. And that's why you're working all the time.
Beautiful. Yeah. Like you said, very much drummers really do have to be that that anchor that kind of holds things together.
Yeah.
Frequently.
Absolutely.
And what was it like for you having come up in music, things like that, having had the career that you've had? What was it like for you to get to work with Sir Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr, two people that literally inspired you into your career path and into your chosen vocation? What was it like to get to share space with them and work with them?
Woohoo! That's what it was like. I couldn't believe it. As you were saying that, I'm going like, oh my God, I can't take it. It's like you're tickling me, and it won't stop tickling me. Because as you were describing it, I was going like, oh my, it's like I'm feeling it for the first time. Yeah, I saw the Beatles at age 10, and 50 years later, I was in a call to be the drummer on a CBS special called The Night That Changed America, which is honoring the Beatles for the Ed Sullivan. 2 million people in North America saw. Changed a lot of people's lives. And now I get to play with them. And some of my other heroes, like Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
And, you know, Joe Walsh from the Eagles, and you know, Jeff Lynne from ELO, and Dave Grohl, who's one of my buddies, and you know, Keith Urban and John Mayer and Brad Paisley and on and on. And then, after I'm done, you know, and I've met Paul before. I met him. I was in the studio doing an Alice Cooper record, and somebody's hand was knocking. All I saw was a hand come through the door and knock on the door. I'm like, come in. I'm on the phone with the producer, and he knocks again. I'm like, I scream, come on in. In walks Paul McCartney. I said to the producer, I got to go. It's McCartney. And the producer went, oh, man, the other guy was cooler, meaning Lennon. I went, well, the other guy's dead. See if I...
Yeah.
And I had a long talk with Paul and Ringo before the show.
Wow.
You know, we rehearsed that day. And then before the show, 45 minutes. The story is unbelievable. So nice. And at the end... my performance, I played with all, nine artists, and it's like 30 minutes left. I walk into this big arena, you know, looking for my wife, and there are these elite seats. It's Tom Hanks and his wife, Ringo Starr and his wife, Paul McCartney's girlfriend, George Harrison's widow, Danny Harrison, Yoko Ono, Sean Lennon. There's these actors like Johnny Depp, Tom Cruise, and Sean Penn. Wow. And I'm going by them, and they're all acknowledging me. But Randall is plotting, sitting down going, bravo, Mr. Aronoff, and he's plotting. And I'm like, I'd met him, you know, and I did the Grammys with him the night before. But I never had this moment, and I was humbled. It was the right, the stars aligned.
Wow.
I get on one knee to go talk to him, and he goes, hey, that's okay, I'm already married. I'm like, no, I'm not asking to marry you. I just started going, you know, you're the reason why I play rock and roll, and you and the Beatles set me on a course, you know. Ever since I was 10 years old, I want to thank you, you know. And I know that may sound stupid, but his wife was going, no, it's beautiful. And that was that moment. And, it's just a weird, it's like a miracle. It's like,
what?
It's so cool. I'm so glad I had that experience.
Yeah, what a beautiful story, man. And what an amazing occasion to get to kind of full circle that feeling, you know.
Yeah.
And to get to relive that feeling in such a special way.
I'm the only drummer. If you think about it, of 72 million people, however many drummers saw them perform on TV, I was the only one 50 years later out of that 72 million that's playing drums with them.
Right?
God.
Yeah.
God, that's a wild. Anyway, it's a nice thing to make me think back and you know, oh my God, that's so cool. If it was somebody else, I'd say it was cool, but that somebody happened to be me, so it's very cool.
Well,
yeah,
you know, and even to be working with the likes of John Fogerty regularly, things like that, and of course Joe Satriani, that kind of stuff.
You've
had such an amazing opportunity of a career, and it must be great to look back to see Uncommon Studios become what it has, to have the long list of albums. I mean, even now, if you go to KennyAronoff.com, people, and check out the discography, we were talking about it before the interview. If you look at 2020, he's already got 5 albums down. Like, this is the middle of February. You've already got 5 albums out. Like,
Oh, you know, and I just text this morning. This is just another day. I text Billy Gibbons. I said, you know, I had this gig. I was going to be the musical director. And I said, Dad, Billy, the budget fell through. So, yeah. But I'm going to be making a record with him in my studio. And, I'll see you. Give me a call and get back. And then I text Jerry Lee Lewis, his wife. Because Jerry, you know, I was playing with him in 2018. And 2 shows in 2019, then he got a stroke. And now Jerry Lee Lewis, this guy invented rock and roll. I mean, he was the king.
Yeah.
I mean, Elvis looked up to him. Johnny Cash looked up to him. Carl Perkins looked up to him. Little Richard looked up to him. And I got to play with Jerry Lee and Little Richard and Fogerty in the Grammys 1 year. But the point is, I was playing with Jerry Lee Lewis. So I sent him a text, and they sent me back a picture of Jerry and his wife, you know. He's sitting in a chair just looking at the camera like, that's right. I'm Jerry Lee Lewis. Got this attitude thing. It's so cool. And they're doing a documentary on him. But, I mean, they email me back or text me back going, we love you, Kenny. Jerry friggin' Lewis.
Oh, that's great.
The guy that, I mean, shit. He changed everything in my business.
Yeah.
And I'm playing with him, and he likes me. He said he loves me. I mean, this shit just blows my mind. I can't get used to it. I can't, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I had to do the movie with Al Pacino. Al Pacino goes, man, you guys, I love this. You guys are so lucky. You get to play music, man. This is awesome. You guys. Just like Al sounds. And it was a movie called Danny Collins. It's about a guy that, you know, made it big, huge, like a Neil Diamond, and then puts out a record, finally puts out a record of his music that he likes. It has nothing to do with hits, and he's playing in a club, and he's loving it, and everyone's yelling, play the hits, and he's frustrated. He says, all right, I'll play the goddamn hit. And we shot a scene at the Hollywood Bowl of him coming out, And there I am counting it off. And my mom was in the movie theater, I think last year, and I forgot to tell her I was in this movie. Or maybe I told her, but she forgot. And she sees me on the screen counting off with one of her favorite actors, Al Pacino. She jumps up out of the chair and goes, "That's my son!"
That's awesome.
Like that. Isn't that awesome?
That is great. Just to see her moment of surprise would be great.
She saw me play with Leonard Bernstein conducting. I mean, I was a child, and she was taking me to Tanglewood to see the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Wow. Yeah.
Nobody, me or her, never thought I'd be on that stage playing music, let alone with Leonard Bernstein conducting Sibelius Fifth Symphony Orchestra, which is a gorgeous piece with this killer timpani part. And, you know, oh my God, I got pictures of it. I had hair down to my shoulders when I could even grow hair. And when he's pointing his finger to me, like, you know, because I got to go this big roll, you know, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, let me ask you this. With your years of playing experience, with your experience getting into college and moving into rock and roll, everything else, whenever you meet people that are trying to get into the industry, that are considering becoming a musician, considering taking this route, or even, you know, going studio-wise professionally, I've encouraged numerous people that I know here in Austin to, hey, man, like, you're amazing. You should really get a session reel together. And they're like, what? Like, it's something that doesn't even cross their mind to be a session player. What is some of the advice that you give to people that are looking to kind of creep their way into other ends of the industry that they may not have considered?
Well, first of all, let's go talk about the session thing. The reason why they may not be looking to be a session drummer, because there are no sessions really anymore.
Mm.
I mean, if people reach out to me. Look, I used to be in the big room 7 days a week, month after month after month, no days off. Now I'm in the big room 6 days a year.
Oh, wow.
No budgets.
Yeah.
Nobody's selling records. Why make a record? When you hear somebody say that, you know you're in trouble. Why make a record? Nobody's buying it. Music's free. So how can it be sessions?
Yeah.
How are they going to pay my rate and six other guys' rate and the engineer in the studio at $3,000 a day?
And the tape
and
fee.
Flights,
and
hotel.
Yeah.
It's insane. There's no, where does that money come from? You got to sell records. No records, no sessions. No sessions, no studio work. So I'm making it work because I created my own studio. And way cheaper, you know. And so I don't even charge for my room. It's just, the price is just what you get per song. And this price gives you the charts I write out, you know, diligently before I even hit a note.
Yep.
The engineer, the room, everything. And that makes it easier. So what I tell people, and, you know, but also the state of the affairs are mediocrity is in. Mediocrity music is in. There's a lot of great stuff out there. But it used to be there was money to promote and build a career. And people like when Mellencamp was coming out, we were competing with the songs of Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, you know, the Police, Zeppelin. We had to compete with that. Billy Joel.
Yeah.
Creedence. We do. Either come up with a great hook line or don't even show up. Come up with a great drum beat. Come up with a great bass part. Come up with a great chorus. Come up with a great bridge. Come up with a great solo. Come up with great, you know, lyrics. Come out with a great new sounds that nobody's ever heard. That's what we were looking at, every inch of the way. And if the record wasn't good, you'd throw it away and start over again because it was money. The record label was like, don't even think about it unless you got something that's going to blow out what's on the radio. So everybody was pushing each other. Nowadays, you get, you know, you're in your home studio. There's nobody looking over your shoulder. You put something together. And you know, and a lot of people don't want to take chances. They're chasing after whatever's on the radio, which is mediocre. So now you're chasing mediocre. And now you come up with something that's just as mediocre. And then you, not only that, but let's just say you have a hit well, next year, we're in a place now where everybody's disposable. Everything's disposable. They like you for a year and then they move on. It's not always the case, but more and more it is because everything is next. It's just like in social media. You post today, you post tomorrow. You post the next day. You post now, you post 4 hours from now. Yeah, I've already seen that. Give me something more. What else you got?
Yeah.
No, I've seen your smile. How about, why don't you stick a toothpick in your eyeball? Yeah, I haven't seen that. We do that. It's kind of a dismal picture I'm depicting, but it's the truth. But what I do say to people about music is, oh man, music is so vital. You know, if I've had a moment where I've been like, I feel good mentally and physically, I start playing music, it's like, therapy. Like I said, mentally, physically, emotionally and physically. And so, play music as much as you can because it makes you feel good. It makes your life better. When you feel good, you affect other people around you. Feelings are huge.
Yeah.
The way you feel affects people around you. So music is really very powerful, very, very important to have in life. Now, some people, all they want to do is do that to make a living. Well, then they have to sometimes get two or three other jobs. Or, you know, they have roommates, to share the rent. And it's worth it to them because they want to play music. And some people, like I speak to doctors and lawyers and successful business people, they're doing it as a hobby. But it's still in their life. It's still making them feel good.
Yep.
And these are choices everybody has to make on their own.
Yeah, I ran sound for numerous lawyer bands. Things like that. People that were just like weekend warriors, you know, like they went out and played cover songs at bars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They were lawyers and paralegals and stuff like that, man. And they had such a good time because, they were just having fun with it, you know?
Exactly. That's the ultimate at whatever level you're playing. That's the ultimate. And the people in the audience are having a good time, you know, and this is the way, you know, anything that's happy and joyful and loving is got 100% value. Unless you're getting off on, like, you know, doing something evil, that's not good.
Yeah.
But anything that's positive, you know, I mean, I didn't really have to say that, but it was so obvious. You just feel anything that creates happiness and good vibes and love and stuff like that is very, very important in the world we live in, both as an individual and as a society.
Absolutely true.
Music does that, you know?
Yeah. Beautifully said, Kenny. Beautifully said. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know that your schedule is crazy stacked right now. Like you were saying, you're getting ready to go out on the road. You're in the middle of studio sessions, just recording like mad. So thank you so much for taking the time for that last little bit of wisdom of find some happiness. Find something that makes you happy. Follow that. Take that vibration to the next person around you. You know, you are the change that affects the world.
Follow your heart, but take action. Just thinking words are just ideas, but feelings are the truth. Follow your heart, but take action. Do something with it and make that feeling get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Because you're going to have a bad day. You will be fired. You will be hired. You will lose. You will win. And when you are living in a place of love and joy from your home, you will persevere through the bad shit. Life is about losing things. It's who is able to deal with it is the ones that are successful.
Mm. Beautifully said. Thank you so much once again for taking the time.
Tell
everybody where they can go to buy your book, where they can go to book you as a speaker, where they can go to book session time with Kenny Aronoff.
Well, get the book. You can go on Amazon.com. You know, just put in sex, drums, rock and roll. If you can't remember that, that's sex, drums, rock and roll. The hardest hitting man joke is Neil Peart was wrote the forward. So that was really amazing. But for sessions, you can go on my website. There should be a session form on my session thing. People reach out to me, and I'll get back to you immediately. for speaking. You can reach out to me there, and I'll send you off to my my agent. He's at Cal Entertainment. I think there's an email on my speaker page. You go to my website, www.kennyaronoff.com, and there's a main page and there's a speaker page. There's all kinds of ways to get in touch with me about all that stuff.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with our audience, to share your vast world of wisdom and time in the industry, and especially your beautiful words at the end there of no matter what it is, man, just persevere, keep with it, stay with it, follow your passion, do what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. Anytime. You are more than welcome to come back and talk about your new book whenever your new book comes out. We'd love to have you back on to promote that. So until next time, take care of yourself, Mr. Aronoff. Audience, take care of yourselves, take care of your hearing, and keep reaching for 11. We'll talk to you soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
This is Talking Sound.